It's Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. First, do you know what a cocoa mat is? What about Schistoricus or an Egeris? If you don't, that's all right. They're a mat made from coconuts, a spinal disorder, and a species of goat. But can you spell them? Our next guest can. In fact, he spelled all of these stumpers and more correctly and won the National Spelling Bee. We've got a champion speller here to share his approach to mastering even the trickiest words. We want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Are you a good speller? Have you ever been in a spelling bee? How did you prepare? Are there words that you can just never remember how to spell? And what questions do you have about getting better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Dev Shah is the winner of the 2023 Scripps National Spelling Bee. He recently wrote a piece in the Washington Post called "I Won the National Spelling Bee. This is What It Takes to Master Spelling." Dev, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, a big congratulations on your win in the summer. What did it feel like to be up there on stage and hear the judges tell you that you spelled that final word correctly?
Yeah, thank you so much. I never really imagined it. Like, as I said, I lost dozens of bees, but it was kind of like a dream come true, and it was really surreal.
And what do you think the difference was this time around that got you to the finals?
I think I really focused on being able to guess a word correctly, and not even, I kind of made a mistake. It's not really guessing, it's kind of predicting. And I really just focused on my battles and picked my battles strategically because there are 11 million competitors, right? And only one can win. So at the end of the day, you have to focus on your strengths.
And you wrote in your Washington Peace post that, you know, to become a good speller and to get ready for a bee like this, you shouldn't be trying to memorize all the words. Why not?
The people who pick out the words, they're expert linguists, and they pick words that you can trick with other words and you can confuse with other words and other simple words. And they pick really obscure words so that you actually have to understand language to really be able to guess it or predict it. And you should prepare for every situation and every scenario because the spelling bee is really volatile and unpredictable.
Yeah, and I think you wrote that there's something like 500,000 words that could be in play. Is that right?
Right, yeah. And they come from a wide variety of languages, and they have a wide variety of definitions. So you have to be prepared for any situation.
Yeah, from what I understand, English is kind of made up of a layer of different languages that have influenced it at one time or another and found their spellings and pronunciations into the language. Is that part of what makes it so difficult and unpredictable?
Yeah, like, for instance, there are words that come from Maori, a language in New Zealand. There are words that come from Native American languages. There are words that come from Dutch, German. So you have to really pin down the phonetic patterns in each of these languages and be able to apply them and piece out a word.
And you wrote that it really helps to know the how and the why of a word when you hear it. Why is that important?
So, especially when you're on stage, you may know 50,000 words, but knowing the how and why means you can apply those patterns and phonics to other words. So I think the application part matters much more than the memorization part.
We're talking with Dev Shah right now, winner of the 2023 Scripps National Spelling Bee. He's with us here to talk about his experience and how to get better at spelling. And Dev, I want to hone in on one of the words that you spelled in the National Bee, Piriosi. How would you approach predicting that spelling if you didn't already know how to spell it?
Okay, so with periesi, so that comes from two Greek parts. The first part is peri, meaning around, like perimeter. And the second part comes from oikos, meaning house, like ecosystem, or ecosphere. So you would kind of just piece it out and from those two parts. And the OE part is what really trips up most spellers. So I got that part. Most of these words have a tricky spot.
Yeah, I'm glad that I wasn't the one to give you the pronunciation for that one, Deb. Thanks for correcting me. And so how would you spell that?
So first it's perimeter, right? So PERI and then oikos, OECI.
Nice. And so when you are asking the judges for that extra information, specifically the definition, what are you looking for when they give you the answer?
So what I'm looking for is words that can give me the clues to these roots. So for instance, in samophile, right? In the definition, it's things or animals that live in sandy soils. And keywords are basically words that give away the roots. So sandy is a keyword. And I thought of roots that meant sand. And instantly I thought of Samos. And that's what gave the rest of the spelling.
Yeah, and samophile was your winning word this year in the B. And the part that seems the trickiest to me in there is that double M in the middle of samophile. How did you figure out that there was two M's?
So the PS and the two M's, those were the tricky spots in that word. And I just thought of other words with Samo because, like, right, sandy soils. I knew other words that started with Samo, and right, that's the application part, being able to apply other roots to new words that you haven't heard of.
Interesting. And another thing that I hear spellers asking the judges a lot is to use a word in a sentence. Why is that helpful?
Honestly, that like really helps in the local bees in the school or regional bee. I personally never ask those. I just like ask them as like a way to get reassurance and calm down a little because nerves are the biggest part, really, managing emotions.
Sure, to buy yourself a little bit of time up there.
To be fair, they don't really pause the timer, they just keep going. So
Gotcha.
you have to be conservative.
And one of your words also in the B this year, I believe in the finals of the national B was, or the first round, I should say, was something that comes from French, ardoise or ardois. That's again, a different language coming into English and being used in the B. What were your thoughts when that word was posed to you?
Well, it certainly isn't like the first time it's happened. The B does prefer a lot of French, Dutch, German, practically every language. So when I heard Ardoise, I was prepared. And I think what really changed this year is was preparing for each situation. And I knew that they were very heavy on French, so I prepared French words as well.
And what is your, I think back to when I learned spelling and it was flashcards and maybe the occasional computer game with spelling, and I can't really think of anything else. So I'm curious, Deb, what's your training routine like? How do you study up?
So, the majority of what it would be is advanced searching, and that's basically like categorizing words in languages and word combinations. So, for instance, in Samophile, the first two letters is PS, right? So I would do a search for words that start with PS, and then I'd go through that list and then analyze like stems and exceptions, because there's never really an always in spelling. There's always going to be a word that breaks the rule. And then I'd focus on vocabulary because vocabulary is a huge part of the competition. You can't get through without mastering vocab. And then I just have someone quiz me, like my father. And I think that helps with managing emotions and that part.
And is there a word or are there types of words that you find particularly frustrating or difficult?
Yeah, for sure. I would say eponyms. Those are basically words that come from names. And the thing is, you can't really ask for roots when it comes to eponyms because they're just names. So it's hard to piece them out, and you kind of just have to use phonetic patterns and your intuition.
And Deb, for people out there, whether they're young, old, and they want to become a better speller, what is your kind of take-home tip for them?
My take-home tip is to expose yourself to more words, because at the end of the day, with spelling, the biggest strength that you can have is an intuition. You're never really going to know how to spell every word right. But if you can just predict a word with an intuition by exposing yourself to more words through reading, watching movies, stuff like that, I think that's the biggest takeaway.
And Deb, as we wrap up, I understand this was your last year of eligibility for the Spelling Bee. Now that you've won it and had this experience, so what are you taking away from it?
What I've taken away from it is to appreciate the journey a little bit more, because the final destination was like winning, right? And that only lasted for a good 20 seconds. So compared to 5 years, I think the journey really mattered a lot more than the whole moment, winning moment.
That is some good advice. Deb, it was really cool to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dev Shah is the winner of the 2023 Scripps National Spelling Bee. He talked with us about his approach to spelling and how we can all become better spellers. In a minute, we'll talk with a linguist about why English spelling in particular is so tricky. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is English a second language for you? If so, what have you observed about spelling in English? Have you found it more or less difficult than other languages? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about spelling. Spelling in English can be pretty strange. For example, why do we have silent K's, like in night? Why do head, heart, and theater all have different vowel sounds, even though they're spelled with the same vowels? We're talking about the irregularities of English spelling, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the history of spelling in English and how our language got so strange? What words do you find tough to spell? Have you coached yourself to spell them well in some way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica Okrent is a linguist and author of books including Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. Erica, welcome back to Central Time. Erica, are you there with us?
Yep. Thanks for having me. Hi.
Hey, good to hear from you. Erica, before we get going, I just want to get your thoughts on what Dev had to say earlier. It was really cool to talk to him. What do you think of what he had to say about spelling and the experience of a bee champion?
Yeah, well, it was really interesting to hear his technique and how he kind of absorbs some patterns and is able to work with them. Because often you'll hear about English spelling and it seems like there is no pattern. How do you do that? And it is true that there's not a rule. You can't say, here are the 100 rules of English spelling, or here are the 1,000 rules of English spelling. You'll never get that. But there are patterns that you can study and absorb as you read and learn languages. And you can't really predict what spelling it's going to be from a list of rules or patterns, but you can back explain. Once you've got the spelling, you can explain it, which most people don't realize, because we like to shrug and say, oh, English spelling, you know, it is what it is. What are you going to do?
And is it fair to say that English is trickier than other languages because of all the layers that have formed it?
It is because of the spelling. So every language has irregularities, things you just have to memorize. Every language is difficult in its own way for people who don't know it yet. But English does have a special difficulty when it comes to spelling. And that has to do with the history of the writing system of English and the layers that went into producing the writing system that we have.
One of the changes that English went through was called the Great Vowel Shift. And from what I understand, words like book with double vowels O used to be pronounced boke, or boot mm-hmm. used to be pronounced boat. Why did that change?
Well, yeah, the spelling used to make sense. It was a long O and it's spelled with two O's. But over time, the vowel system of English shifted, and that had to do, and that happened right as the writing system was developing. And we were coming out of the years of where we didn't really use English as a written language. French was the written language in England for a long time. And when English writing started coming back and the printing press started coming in, different regions of English were of England were pronouncing things in very different ways, and the whole system was shifting. The range of the vowels were different from place to place and from region to region, and the spelling got fixed in a haphazard way from here to there, and whose spelling was being used.
And I think of, you know, reading historical documents, even from the colonial era here in America, and you see a lot of phonetic spelling too. When did phonetic spelling kind of take hold and then go out of style?
Well, the original written English, old English of, you know, the year 800, was very, very regular and phonetic. And then some, but there was, it wasn't really written down to begin with. And then when it, some Roman priests came in and started writing, using it as a written language, they didn't have all those sounds in Latin, and they had to come up with ways of approximating these strange English sounds. So that gave us things like the GH for this H sound that we had, and don't have anymore, but that spelling stayed. And then it stopped being a written language for a long time. And when it came back, there were just many ways of spelling things that were phonetic to the people that were writing here and there in different places, but not for other people who were also using English. So what was once phonetic became kind of random in which one got accepted and used the most.
We're talking with Erica Okrent right now, linguist and author of books, including Highly Irregular. We're talking about the English language and why its spelling can be so tricky. Erica, another thing I wanted to ask about is the silent K. And it sounds like this is a spelling left over from old English. Words like night and knife used to have the K make an actual sound. And I'm interested in this partly because my own last name, Knetter, still has that K in there. why did those K's stop making their sound?
Well, yes, that was from the period of time when our spelling system was very phonetic and very regular, and we actually pronounced those words with the K sound. Then natural language changes, which happened to every language, changed the sound system, and that initial K dropped out. And, you know, other languages like Spanish has that double L, which isn't pronounced as a double L because it changed. It's that one was sort of a natural change over time. That sound disappeared, but we had already kind of stabilized the spelling of that. So that is a natural change that happens in languages. But English had various other things like the vowel system shift, and also adopting a lot of other words from other languages, and learning to use English again as a written language after this long period of not being a written language, that make it unlike other languages and why they lost letters or lost sounds.
I also want to ask about the example that's right in the title of your book, why tough, through, and dough all make different sounds despite having that O-U-G-H at the end of all of them.
Yeah, that one's a real tricky one, especially for learners of English and for kids learning to write. Like, this makes no sense. What is the rule here? But if you look at, you know, the history, that GH, that actually stands for something that used to be there, this huh sound, that changed over time, either dropped out or changed to an F sound in different regions of England. And the vowels were originally three different vowels that were written three different ways. that then overlapped with this new way of trying to write vowels down while we were in the midst of this sound change where different regions did everything differently and landed in this place where it looks like they should all be the same vowel, but they never were. And there's an interesting, the do one, we have the do, and that GH became an F, and it's still a word in England for a special kind of dessert called duff. Plum duff is a sort of Christmas dessert. And it's the same word, it's dough, but for that word, it went the F way. And for the dough word, it dropped out, but it's that GH, that H sound, that's where it came from in both cases. And it went two separate ways, and we've got different spellings.
And Erica, just in our last minute, all of this can make English pretty tough to spell, probably pretty tough to learn for someone coming into it the first time, but does it make it interesting to study?
Oh yeah, definitely. I love seeing a word and thinking, huh, I wonder why is it spelled this way and pronounced this way? And you can look it up and the answer is in the history and the layers of this history where it's not as simple as it seems, because every layer complicated it a bit more. But I love tracking down those things and hunting for the answer for why is this way?
Well, we'll leave it there. Erica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Erica Okrent is a linguist and the author of books including Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. She talked to us about why English spelling can be so challenging. Earlier, we talked with Dev Shah, winner of the 2023 Scripps National Spelling Bee. I'm Dean Kinetter. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Now it's Food Friday, and we're celebrating one of those things that can create true happiness and unity. What is it? For the answer, we turn to Martin Short.
Nothing brings people together like a common enemy. That or a good cheese plate.
And we agree. We love a good cheese board. And platters and boards are having a moment. From social media trends like butter boards and girl dinner snack trays to those elaborate photogenic tables you see at weddings, they are in. Our next guest says, we don't need to go overboard, though, when it comes to putting together a tasty, memorable cheese board. He's here to share some simple, budget-friendly ways we can make a crowd-pleasing spread for our next gathering. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of cheese to put on a cheese board? Do you have a signature element that you always add to your party trays and platters to make them stand out? What questions do you have about putting a good party tray together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ken Monteleone is the creative director and owner of Formagination, an artisan cheese shop in Madison. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Yeah, good to have you. And as I mentioned, we see a lot of these trays on social media. Some of them are pretty wild. They are expensive, glamorous. We don't necessarily need to go in that direction, though, do we?
I agree. I totally agree. During the pandemic, people had a lot of time on their hands, so building a cheese board became like an art activity. And yes, food should look beautiful because we obviously eat with our eyes first, but you can do it in all sorts of ways. And I think keeping it as reasonable as possible within your budget makes a lot of sense.
And if we're thinking about putting together a cheese board for our next gathering, what are some of the questions we should back up and ask ourselves before we go out there and start buying?
Well, the first thing I would do is go with what you like. And, you know, what I like to do is if you like cheddar, then make sure you have a cheddar on your plate. But before you go out and shop, look in your refrigerator, because there's a lot of things in your pantry and your refrigerator you may be able to use to put that board together. So, you know, during the holidays, to me, it's a great way to take the stress out of entertaining and just come up with some great Wisconsin cheese and some pairings to go with it, and then let your creativity go from there and create a nice board for you and your friends.
And speaking of great Wisconsin cheese, you were very kind to us today and you brought a platter up to the studio with you. Could you talk first about the cheeses you picked out?
Yeah. So what I did when we were looking at this board is, you know, during the holidays, people are gathering with friends and family. You don't always know their taste. So I always put two crowd-pleasing cheeses on a board and then one adventurous cheese. Mm. So what I did is Wisconsin, we're known for cheddar. So why not start with the great Hook's 5-year cheddar? You know, Hook's does a great job of aging cheddars up to 20 years, but a 5-year is kind of that middle zone before it becomes too, it's sharp enough, but it becomes a little smooth and you can start to taste those crystals in it. So we start with the cheddar and then we move up from there. Another crowd-pleasing cheese is Sartori does an amazing job of creating some unique flavors. On the tray today, we put the Balavitano Sartori. And the reason I like that cheese is that plum and sweetness, if you're drinking wine, it's a perfect companion. And there's so many things that can pair on your board with the Sartori Balavitano Merlot. And then kind of that adventurous cheese is one of the most decorated cheese in Wisconsin, and that's Pleasant Ridge Reserve. It's made by Andy Hatch in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. What makes this cheese special is it is one of the most awarded cheeses in the country, and rightfully so, because he goes to great lengths to craft this cheese. His cows are grazing on pastures. They're eating legumes. They're eating floral notes. They're eating quality product throughout the grazing season, which produce wonderful milk. So that's also on our board today.
Yeah, that's one of the greatest examples of what they call an alpine cheese that has those nutty flavors to it. What are some other good alpine cheeses people should keep an eye out for?
There are so many out there, and Wisconsin's known for alpine cheeses because a lot of people that moved to Wisconsin in the 185 years ago were from Europe, so they brought their Swiss traditions. A good Emmental is always good. Roth also does some wonderful cheeses. They have a cheese called the Grand Cru that I would definitely put on any board. But it goes on and on. We also have some Cave H cheddars. I don't know if you're familiar with Bluemont Dairy. Oh,
so tasty.
A wonderful bandage cheddar. That would also be a wonderful cheese for a board.
Yeah, I love having that chance on the board to expose people to something new, a cheese that sort of tells a story. And the other cheese from Uplands Cheese, which makes Pleasant Ridge, is Rush Creek Reserve. And that, if we're willing to go there, can be a great centerpiece. Could you tell us about that one?
Yeah, Rush Creek is one of those cheeses Andy introduced in 2010, so it's celebrating its 13th year. What makes that cheese special is it's only available when the cows aren't grazing on the summer pastures. That's kind of his winter cheese. And for a cheesemaker to only make two cheeses, I mean, that is a commitment to greatness because he's putting all his resources in Pleasant Ridge Reserve in the spring and summer months and then coming up with this Rush Creek that's actually wrapped in a spruce bark, and it's modeled after a French cheese. And what makes it unique, and it can be a wonderful centerpiece for any board, is you cut the top off. You could heat it in a brie baker, and it becomes like a mini fondue. And it pairs with so many wonderful things, not only from potatoes and root vegetables, but just dipping it in bread can be the centerpiece of any event you're having during the holidays.
We're talking with Ken Monteleone right now, creative director and owner of Fromagination, an artisan cheese shop in Madison. And we're talking how to put together a great cheese board, a great party platter for your next gathering. You can call in too at 800-642-1234 with things you like to put on a tray or questions you have about putting a good one together. Now, Ken, you've got a lot of other great stuff on this board you brought up today. I see sugared cranberries, crackers, crisps, figs. It's gorgeous. When we're putting together one for our next party, should we be thinking about things to pair directly with the cheese, like have a one-to-one pairing ratio, or just sort of fill it out with things that we think could work?
Well, you kind of start with the cheese. To me, start your base with three cheeses. Mm-hmm. We like to go with odd numbers. So 3, 5, 8 cheeses. I like to say 3 is a good number for any event. And then think about what pairs best with the three cheeses on the board. What I like to say is in Wisconsin, I said, you know, cheddars are what we do. So why not pair it with cranberries? We're one of the largest producers of cranberries in the country. And during the holidays, you not only have the fresh cranberries that we actually sugar, you can get some simple syrup and put sugar on them so it has a festive look. And then you can taste the cranberries raw, or we also have sweetened cranberries. And cranberries, to me, go perfect with cheddar. The other thing that I have on the board today is apricots. You know, we think of dried fruits in the winter months, and apricots, because of the pineapple notes that sometimes you taste in the Pleasant Ridge Reserve, that's a perfect complement to enjoying the Uplands Pleasant Ridge Reserve. And then you kind of go from there. So you start with your cheeses. You can cut it in various ways, and we can talk about that later in terms of what techniques in terms of really showcasing the best flavors of the cheese are. But then kind of just fill it in, you know, so everything from crackers to something crunchy. So on the board today, we have some corn nuts. You can do snap peas. You know, it's not only dried fruits and nuts and savory items. Also think fresh fruits and vegetables also pair nicely with cheese. And then you just kind of expand it, the landscape, as you kind of work your way around the board.
Yeah. We are taking your calls also on this conversation about cheese trays and platters at 800-642-1234. And we've got someone on the phones right now. Chris is with us in Evansville. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thank you very much for the information. I'm just wondering about a cheese that has horseradish. What could you recommend? Thank you.
Oh, Chris, thanks for the call. Ken, anything you know about with horseradish?
Yeah, I think thanks for the call. Thanks for calling in today. I think horseradish, I think charcuterie. So I would do some cured meats would pair perfectly with a horseradish cheese. Some mustard would also accent it. Some olive tapenade would go great. Some bread that you toast and put some olive oil on it would go great with the horseradish cheese. There's so many options. So what was your first, when you think horseradish, what do you think of, Chris?
Oh, Chris, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Everything you mentioned sounds really good. I was thinking kind of the same thing, like some crusty bread, maybe grilled or melted a little bit with some onion on it.
Yeah, the other thing that comes to mind, that sounds delicious, is summer sausage would also go great with a horseradish cheese. And in Wisconsin, we have plenty of great summer sausages available.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thanks for that call. And Ken, you mentioned earlier, it's important to slice a cheese the right way for what kind of cheese it is. How do we go about that?
Yeah, so there's always these questions. Do you eat the rind or you don't eat the rind? Like cheeses like Pleasant Ridge Reserve, a lot of work goes into that rind. You know, Andy Hatch and his team are actually rubbing and washing that cheese daily. So it's part of what makes that cheese great is the care that goes in from the rind and as it seeps into the cheese. So the rule of thumb is if it's a wax rind, obviously don't eat it. But if it's a wash rind cheese, taste it. If you like it, obviously eat it. If not, just put it aside. But what we like to do on cheeses like Pleasant Ridge Reserve, we like to cut it in long triangles because you want to taste from the rind all the way to the core of the cheese. So if you cube the cheese, you're going to miss some of those flavors. So that's the reason that sometimes we don't cube cheeses. And aesthetically, it looks a lot better on a board when it's cut in a long triangle. And some exceptions to that would be on our tray today, we have Hook's 5-Year Cheddar. Traditionally, you can cube 5-Year Cheddar, but if you're trying to do the art on a cheese board, why not do it in little matchsticks? So just being creative, you don't have to buy tons of books to find out the perfect board. Just let your imagination go wild and do what you think looks great. And that's part of the fun, is we eat with our eyes first. So putting the beauty into, you're not having to cook, so we're taking the stress out of all the labor that goes into cooking, so you can put that creativity on creating your own board.
Yeah, rule one, it should be fun, right?
It should be fun, yes.
We got a question from our producer, Beatrice, who asked, can we eat the brie rind or not?
Oh, I would definitely eat the brie rind. I think that's part of the beauty of brie. And a lot of people do come to the shop and ask, is the rind on a brie edible? And again, taste it. If you like it, I would definitely eat it. A lot of people in the holiday seasons, they will wrap brie in phyllo dough and bake it. So we're definitely in the brie season, and there's so many things you can do with a great brie, but I would definitely eat the rind.
We're talking with Ken Monteleone right now, owner of Fromage Nation in Madison. We're talking about how to put together a great cheese board, a great party platter for your next gathering, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you the platter or board maker for your family gatherings? What makes yours stand out? Are there certain cheeses or meats you like to put on your boards? And what are your favorite Wisconsin ingredients to share with your family and friends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ken Monteleone, creative director and owner of Fromagination, an artisan cheese shop in Madison. It's Food Friday, and we're talking about a Wisconsin favorite, cheese boards. We're taking your calls, your questions, too, at 800-642-1234. Ken, before the break, we were talking about pairings and making sure that, you know, pairings don't, a cheese or a pairing doesn't overwhelm one or the other. The big elephant in the room is blue cheese. How do you incorporate blue cheese onto a board, or do you?
Yeah, blue cheese is one of those categories you just never know if you're entertaining people that you don't know their taste is always leave it on its own board. The challenge with blue cheese, I happen to love blue cheese, but they're very strong and pungent in flavor. So once you taste a blue cheese, it can fatigue your palate. So you may not be able to taste anything else on your board. So if you want to serve a blue cheese, you can do a blue cheese board if you're that adventurous, or keep the blue cheese on its own. I love pairing blue cheese with figs, walnuts, honey. There's so many things that go great with blue cheese, peanut brittle, chocolate.
Peanut brittle, wow.
Yeah, it's amazing what complements a blue cheese. And to me, it can be a dessert. You know, it can be its own end of dinner dessert. So I would definitely not shy away from blue cheeses, but if you're putting it on a board, I'd be very careful because you may not be able to taste some of the other flavors once you dive into that blue cheese.
Sure. And you mentioned honey, which is great with blue cheese. I also love fig jam.
Fig is, yes.
With all kinds of cheeses. Probably best to have those in sort of a small container on a tray, though.
Yeah, I'd put them in a little ramekin. I mean, there's so many options. This is your time, if you're building a board, is go into your pantry and pull out some of that stuff that you never use, especially if you're entertaining for the holidays, and just make that part of your board because it's amazing what creativity you can come up with when you just start exploring the options that you may have at home and some of the things that just sit in your pantry or in your cupboards throughout the year. You can use them as part of your board.
And during the holidays especially, we have people coming in from out of state, and it's a good chance to just show off a little bit, right, about what Wisconsin has to offer. Obviously, the cheeses are there. Are there other items for the board, those meats, crackers, things like that, that you would recommend come from Wisconsin that we can be proud about?
Yeah, we're so blessed in Wisconsin because dairy represents a big part of our economy and spinoff business the last, since I've had the shop 16 years, have really come up, like Potter's Crackers made here locally. There's Preserve Makers. There's so many different companies doing wonderful charcuterie. From in Madison, we have Underground Meats doing some wonderful cured meats. In the Driftless region, we have so many options from Driftless Provisions. So it's endless. Cranberries, we mentioned, is a big thing in Wisconsin. So it's endless in terms of what's available here locally.
Let's go back to the phones right now. We have Randy on the phone with us in Verona. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about?
I've often attempted to warm up brie, but in the microwave it turns to soup, and unless I'm really attentive. And so I'm wondering with that, with brie as well as the Rush Creek, is it better just to leave it out in the air all day so it gets soft, or is there a better way to warm it prior to serving?
Randy, thanks for the question. Ken, what do you think?
Yeah, Randy, that is a great question. And what I like to say is a couple of options for you. First of all, we always get the question, what temperature should you serve any cheese? And the answer to that is let the cheese breathe at room temperature for at least 30 minutes before serving. And in terms of answering your question regarding a brie, what I would do is you can let it sit out for over an hour so it gets really soft. Or you can put it in the oven in a bowl, if you don't have a little brie baker, at 250. So gently warm it up. I would not put the temperature higher than 250. And then just check it after 15 minutes to the ripeness or the softness that you prefer. The mistake a lot of people make is putting it in the microwave, it will become rubbery. Or preheating it at 350, that's way too high for a brie cheese. So starting at a very gentle temperature should get you where you want to go.
Randy, thanks for that call. Ken, we also we talked earlier about being adventurous on our cheese board and having that one, maybe two cheeses that push people out of their comfort zone. One way to do that is with different types of milk, right?
Oh, most definitely. We haven't talked about, you know, in Wisconsin, we're known for cow's milk, but there's some wonderful cheesemakers doing sheep milk and goat milk. And for the holidays, we have one cheesemaker that comes to mind, and that's Blakesville Creamery. They're actually doing two cheeses only for the holidays. One is called Holiday Cheer, and it's their version of a Wisco Old Fashioned. So what they do, it's wrapped in a grape leaf, it's soaked in a brandy. They also add some orange to it, and the cheese is amazing. It looks like a little present when you unwrap it. So that would be one cheese from Blakesville out of Port Washington. The other one is truffles. We're in the truffle season for the holidays. People tend to love anything truffle. And we have, Blakesville is doing a cheese called the Truffle Shuffle. And that is a goat milk cheese that also has some truffles in it. And then you have the whole category of sheep milk cheeses. That, to me, that is pushing some people out of their comfort zone that tend to eat only cow's milk cheese.
Yeah, Blakesville is about 10 minutes from where I grew up, actually. They're a newer cheesemaker, but incredible stuff.
Yeah, really, really very tasty. Great stuff, yes.
We got an email from Grant, who said that Chalet Cheese Co-op in Monroe makes a hybrid cheese called Panaro, which is a blend of Gouda and Parmesan. They also sell an aged version of this cheese that is a stunner. Grant, thanks for that email. Ken, have you heard of that one?
No, thank you for telling me about that. I'm going to have to look into that. I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Grant, thanks for the recommendation there. And still maybe time for your calls or recommendations at 800-642-1234. Ken, as we put together the cheeses and other things on a board, a lot of work goes into these cheeses, a lot of time, so they can be on the expensive end. Are there sort of more inexpensive cheeses that are still going to be crowd pleasers and still really tasty stuff?
Oh, there's so many cheeses out there. I think there's a cheese for everyone out there, and this kind of, it doesn't have to be the most expensive cheese to be on your board. In Wisconsin, we're blessed to have so many varieties. I believe there's 600 varieties of cheeses and over 100 of different styles of cheese at all price ranges. So, go out and explore what you like and taste it first. I definitely wouldn't buy, if you're buying artisan cheeses, I would really want to taste before you buy. But most shops in Wisconsin will allow you to do that because, after all, I like to say we dream in cheese in the state of Wisconsin.
And, everything old is new again. The cheese ball, the classic cheese ball, in or out?
I think they're in. I think you can get great, very creative with the cheese ball. So no shame at all in serving the cheese ball because I think it brings back a lot of childhood memories. And, cheese balls were popular in the 70s, and I think there's so many creative ways to make your own cheese ball.
And what should we be thinking about in terms of, we have our board on the table, how should we set people up to eat off it, to serve themselves?
Yeah, that's always tricky because now that we're kind of coming out of the pandemic, people are gathering again, and you want to make sure you have utensils that are appropriate so that you don't have those double dippers going at your cheese board. So just having some tongs next to each cheese. Normally, if you're doing a large gathering, I would slice the cheeses. If it's a very small gathering, you can have a knife out so people can show them how to cut the first few slices, and then they can cut after that. So just have utensils next to the cheeses and some of the companions so people kind of can maneuver their way around the board.
We've talked about some of them already, but what are the other cheeses like that are tasting really good right now that you're excited about this time of year?
Oh, that there are so many. I eat cheese daily, but a lot of the truffle cheeses I'm really liking right now. And anything soaked, there's so many different flavors of cheeses, from cheeses soaked in various wines to spicy cheeses. And spicy cheeses, I think, are having a moment right now. So I would definitely go to your grocery store and explore all the different cheeses that are either soaked in beer, in wine, in habanero peppers. One cheese that I really liked is called the Deer Creek Rattlesnake. Mm-hmm. It's soaked in tequila and habanero peppers. So if you like spicy, there's a cheese for everyone. So you name a category and you can probably find a cheese in that category.
Well, Ken, you've given us a lot to work with and a lot to think about and to snack on here in the studio. So thanks for coming up today.
It's been a pleasure to join you today. Thank you.
Ken Monteleone is creative director and owner of Formaggination. We've been talking about how to put together a great cheese board for our next family gathering. Yesterday on the show, we talked with the author of a book about the history of college radio. We also asked for your stories, and you came through. James on Facebook said, I was a DJ at WWSP, Stevens Point, in the mid-2000s, and still play the yearly trivia contest there. Kathy on Facebook wrote that during her time on college radio playing classical music, she learned the hard way to always have a backup ready for when the Tchaikovsky tape spun off the reel, and the closest thing she had was Elton John's Blue Eyes. Kathy says, kind of an abrupt culture shock. Eric said that it was October during his first radio shift. He writes that the campus was blanketed in fog, so he pretended it was snow and played holiday tunes. Eric says, I had a few calls from some overstressed and strung-out students who said, hey man, what day is it? You're freaking me out. Well, you can rest assured, it's December 8th, and there's more to come here on Central Time.